This program is sponsored by Norwich University.
The following is a production of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. Bringing citizens and citizen soldiers together through the exploration of military history, topics, and current affairs. This is Pritzker Military Presents.
Welcome to Pritzker Military Presents with author Stephen Sodergren discussing his book, The Army of the Potomac in the Overland and Petersburg Campaigns. I'm your host, Jay Williams, and this program is coming to you from the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in downtown Chicago. It's sponsored by Norwich University. This program and hundreds more are available on demand at PritzkerMilitary.org. The Civil War fundamentally reshaped American life. Its effects reverberated throughout politics, religion, race relations, and even the physical landscape of the United States. It also shaped military practice and ideas about effective warfare that persisted until World War I. In the Army of the Potomac in the Overland and Petersburg Campaigns, Stephen E. Sodergren examines these transformations in the practice of modern warfare, particularly the introduction of trench warfare and campaigns of attrition. These grim new realities significantly affected the mindset and morale of Union soldiers. Sodergren shows how increases in the level and frequency of combat beginning with the 1864 Overland Campaign caused tremendous physical and emotional suffering for the men of the Army of the Potomac. By the end of this series of battles, some Union soldiers began to express doubt in their cause and in their leaders. The result was widespread demoralization and a rising number of men disobeying orders and even deserting. During the Petersburg campaign that followed, soldiers found a degree of security in trench warfare, as well as access to mail, quality food, and other luxuries that being dug in allowed. This was regenerative both physically and psychologically. Sodergren argues that Union soldiers were greatly heartened by the re-election of Abraham Lincoln in November 1864. They then endured the brutal conditions of trench warfare to emerge with a renewed sense of purpose that would ultimately win the war in 1865. Drawing on a wealth of original documents, including soldiers' letters and diaries, official military correspondence, and court-martial records, Sodergren paints a moving picture of the daily lives of Union soldiers as they experienced a profound shift in the way their world waged large-scale warfare. Stephen Sodergren earned a BA in History and Philosophy from Cornell College and an MA and PhD in American and Military History from the University of Kansas. During his graduate career, he earned a dissertation fellowship from the U.S. Army Center of Military History for his work on the adaptation of Union soldiers to tactical conditions during the American Civil War. Sodergren has taught in the History and Political Science Department at Norwich University since 2007. His first book, The Army of the Potomac, won the 2018 William E. Colby Military Writers Award. Please join me in welcoming Stephen Sodergren to the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.
Thank you all for being here at the wonderful facilities here at the Pritzker Military Library. It's my pleasure to be here, standing before you, offering some thoughts on my book that has generally done quite well. I'm honored to be the recipient of the 2018 William E. Colby Military Writers Award. It was a delightful surprise to see such work of mine recognized in such a manner. If I could begin today, I'd like to start by talking really about where the inspiration for this project came from. And a lot of it had to do with my upbringing in the area. Although I'm currently located in Vermont teaching at Norwich University, I grew up in the Chicago area. I'm from Glen Ellyn, Illinois, born and raised. Highland Park, born and raised, excuse me, but eventually moved out to Glen Ellyn. And being raised there, I had the opportunity to visit a museum that was in the area on several occasions, and that is the 1st Division Museum that you can find in Wheaton, Illinois. Cantigny Park, Big Red One Museum. If you have not been, it's a wonderful facility. They've had a series of great events recently for the centennial of the First World War. And, you know, as a kid, It just seemed so overwhelming to me when I first went there. It was either on a school trip, or I know that my dad, Lieutenant Colonel Theodore Sodergren, United States Air Force retired, took me there on more than one occasion. And at first I was just excited to jump all over the tanks. They've got Sherman tanks, old Stuart tanks and stuff like that in the park there. But as time went on, I went into the museum and they had some magnificent exhibits on the First World War. And it was there that I began to learn about the First World War. And that's when I came around to what is the prevalent and accepted thinking about the First World War, and that is trench warfare is terrible. It is horrific. It is dehumanizing. 4 years of men fighting in blood and ugliness, and it just seemed to crush the human spirit. And the more I researched about this, the more I learned that the First World War really kind of set the standard for trench warfare as the epitome of war at its worst, ground warfare at its worst, perhaps. And really, if you do research in the First World War, there's one person who really encapsulated a lot of these ideas, and it was somebody who was there. Charles Wilson, eventually Lord Charles Wilson, was a British medical officer in the First World War. And he saw firsthand what trench warfare did to the human beings exposed to it. He was attached to a Royal Fusiliers unit. He served in the Western Front from 1914 to 1917. And after the war was over, he had spent years treating the physical, but also the mental wounds that men received from their experience with trench warfare. The idea that prolonged experience to that would eventually destroy them. And after the war was over, he went on to a rather illustrious career. He was he went into a medical career. He went on to become Winston Churchill's personal doctor. But at the end of the Second World War, Charles Wilson Moran published his book, Anatomy of Courage. It's a great book if you haven't read it. It's a wonderful window into the mentality of particularly World War I soldiers. And in that book, he reaches certain conclusions. And they basically confirm the superficial take that we have on trench warfare. It's horrible, but also that men cannot endure it. Specifically, he says, a man's courage is his capital, and he is always spending. Moran reaches the conclusion that the longer men are exposed to trench warfare, and actually just broadly combat in general, the more likely it is they will crack. No matter how brave you are, he says, no matter how crazy you are, eventually you will collapse under the strain. As he concludes, no man can go on forever. Sooner or later, all men feel fear. We know, looking backward from World War I, that trench warfare is horrible. So imagine in my early days of studying the Civil War to discover that there was trench warfare in the Civil War, that trenches were a prevalent contributor to the combat tactics of the Civil War era. When we think of the Civil War, we don't think of trench warfare. We think of long, tidy rows of men marching across an open field. We think of Pickett's Charge, of men being slaughtered in broad numbers by rifle and artillery fire, which, if you think about it, is not all that different from charging across a no man's land. But over the course of the Civil War, tactics changed. Over the course of the Civil War, we see men removed from an open field setting and engaging more in what we would call trench warfare, wars of field fortifications. And really in that final year, from 1864 to 1865, we see that coming to fruition. There had been experimentation. It's not like the Civil War generation invented trench warfare. But there was a recognition as time went on that maybe this is not working, these open field tactics. Maybe there's no cowardice in digging a hole in the ground to protect yourself from musketry and artillery shells. And so by the end of the war, both sides are routinely digging in wherever they go. And perhaps connected to that, it's the last year of the war that is among the bloodiest fighting that you will see in the Civil War. And it fascinated me to see how soldiers, particularly Union soldiers, responded to this. How did they adapt or fail to adapt to these changing combat conditions on the ground? But there was another issue that I wanted to study here. Not necessarily whether or not they adapted to the tactics, but also how did they win? A lot of historians, unfortunately, see the war as sort of a foregone conclusion following Gettysburg. It's the high tide of the Confederacy, which suggests everything's downhill from then. So the Union was obviously going to win. Nobody knew that in 1864. You listen to the soldiers and they're planning out the next 2 or 3 years of war ahead of them. They're enlisting for 3 or 4 more years. Nobody knew the war was going to last another year. How did they persevere? How did they adapt? How did they win? And that is another question that I sought to answer with my narrative. Not only how did men respond to combat conditions, but how did they persevere and emerge victorious from them? And so my research involved examining over 170 soldiers, particularly their letters and their diaries, to get a window into who these guys were, particularly the Army of the Potomac, the largest Union army in the last year of the war. This was the force that was directing its onslaught against Richmond, Virginia, and the Army of Robert E. Lee. 120,000 men. What did they think? How did they respond to these changing combat conditions? And my surprise was that they had adapted after significant rough patches. They adapted well. They endured. They survived. And I think that they're a wonderful display of the American citizen soldier spirit that is pervasive in almost any conflict. So I'd like to begin by talking about that last year in the war. My focus is on the East. My focus is on the embattled Richmond, Washington, D.C. corridor that by spring of 1864 had seen its fair share of fighting. Well, it really hasn't seen anything yet. In spring of 1864, a new commander emerged in the Union Army, and that was Ulysses S. Grant. The hero of Vicksburg, as he was known, he arrives in the East not as commander of the Army of the Potomac. That position would be held by George Gordon Meade, the victor of Gettysburg, but even larger. Ulysses S. Grant is the general-in-chief of the Union Army. He commands every single Union soldier in the field. And when he takes command in 1864, his plan is to advance. He wants to pressure the Confederacy to collapse. And thus is the origin of the spring 1864 campaign, what becomes known as the Overland Campaign. The Overland Campaign begins as yet another push by the Union forces towards Richmond. But really, it's a little bit different than that. The idea is that they're not just going to push towards Richmond, they're going to try to bag Lee's army too. If you take out Lee's army, you can take Richmond anytime you want. And so that is the target. And to do that, the Army of the Potomac amasses 120,000 men, nearly its largest size to that point in the war, to face down approximately 60 to 65,000 men in Lee's army. And on May 1st, 1864, the army advances, once more into the breach for the Army of the Potomac. And the men are hopeful. Grant has a great reputation. They look around. They see the large numbers around them. They will win. Put simply, the battles that would occur in May and June 1864 were unlike anything that had been seen in the Eastern Theater before this. It is the bloodiest fighting of the entire war. For 40 days, from May 5th to June 15th, 1864, the two armies engage in a death struggle where they don't let go of one another. 40 days, 100 miles. 4 big battles, dozens of smaller skirmishes, and by the end of it, 55,000 Union casualties. If you do the math, Grant's going to lose 45% of his army in this campaign. The Confederates are going to lose an equal number, proportionally. One historian has called this constant, grinding, all-destroying warfare, and this is where we see the Civil War change. From a war of periodic battles separated by weeks and months to constant slogging along a single line in Richmond, towards Richmond. And it begins with the Wilderness. The Wilderness becomes famous for its title, occurring in a wooded area. Lee is crafty, and he knows that he's massively outnumbered, so he strikes Grant where he knows he'll be weakness. By the way, Grant is not in command of the Army of the Potomac specifically, but he's along for the ride. He realizes this is the main route of advance, so Grant's there calling the shots. least strikes in the wooded area near the Chancellor's house, where a battle had been fought almost exactly a year earlier at Chancellorsville, and manages to negate Union superiority in numbers and artillery, and the result is a bloody fratricidal conflict, with the woods catching on fire and soldiers blindly firing sometimes into their own men. The fighting goes on for 3 days, May 5th to the 7th, and the soldiers struggle with it. The Union Army loses 17,000 men. Private Robert McBride, 11th Pennsylvania, refers to the Wilderness as a tragedy, grandly, awfully sublime. While another soldier, Private John Haley, from the 17th Maine, would just call it a dreadfully mixed-up mess. The Wilderness is not unique in any sort of manner. In many ways, it followed the pattern of previous battles, Fredericksburg, Chancellorsville, the Bull Runs, the 7 Days campaigns. Union Army advances, Lee does his thing, stymies that advance, inflicts casualties. But what happens next is where we begin to see the shift occur in the Eastern Theater. After the Wilderness, does the Army of the Potomac retreat to lick its wounds? No. Grant, to quote him, keeps moving on. He will not let up. He will keep pushing. And he is lauded by historians for this, for his tenacity, for his stubbornness. But he's asking his men, who just fought one of the bloodiest battles of the war, to go and fight another one the next day. And then after that, another one. And then another one. And another one. The war has changed, and Grant is asking a great deal of his men. And that is very representative by the Battle of Spotsylvania. As Grant moves on May 8th to try to sweep around the Confederate flank, he gets stopped again by Confederate forces near Spotsylvania Courthouse. What follows is 2 weeks of intermittent combat as Grant tries to feel out the Confederate position, to get around Lee, to encircle him so he can destroy his army. But Lee's men are always there. They're always in the way. And what are they in? Trenches. Lee's men, by this point in the war, have realized a good way to stop an attack is to dig in and hit them with firepower. And that's exactly what will happen on May 12th. The highlight, or lowlight, if you will, of the Spotsylvania battles occurs on May 12th with the attack on the Muleshoe Salient, where Grant throws 2 Army Corps at a salient in the Confederate lines. This is, in my opinion, the bloodiest fighting of the entire war. For 24 straight hours, the two sides just keep throwing reinforcements at each other. It's pouring down rain for much of this, which means their black powder weapons won't work. So what do they have to use? Bayonets, rifle muskets, clubs, their fists. It's ugly, and that's what everybody agrees. Private John Haley, again, refers to the Muleshoe as a seething, bubbling, roaring hell of hate and murder. Private Wilbur Fisk of the 2nd Vermont calls it the most singular and obstinate fighting that I have seen during the war or ever heard or dreamed of in my life. It's at Spotsylvania that soldiers adopt a different tone, the superlative. These guys aren't green soldiers. They are veterans. Wilbur Fisk has been in since 61, Haley since 62. They've seen the elephant, but they haven't seen this before. Warfare has changed, and they increasingly struggle with that change. And it goes on and on and on. After Spotsylvania, they move on to the North Anna River, which could be called a lull in the campaign, if you accept the fact that a battle of 7,000 casualties lost to the Union is a lull. It is the smallest battle of the campaign as Grant manages to push past Lee's army that is guarding the approaches to the North Anna River in Virginia. But it pales in comparison to Spotsylvania, where on May 12th alone, the Union loses 9,500 men. The casualties keep piling up, but Grant's moving forward. It seems like he's making progress. It seems like every day he's getting closer to Richmond. But the casualties are piling up and the men are suffering. And no better place is that scene than Cold Harbor. The Cold Harbor battlefield becomes really synonymous with Civil War slaughter. The idea of Grant throwing his legions against a well-entrenched Confederate position. And that is what happens on the morning of June 3rd. 2 to 3 Army Corps are thrown against a well-prepared Confederate position, and the result is 7,000 more Union casualties. But what I found interesting is the soldiers noted that it was terrible. As one Massachusetts soldier noted, amid such an iron hail of grape canister and bullets, I cannot conceive of how anyone escaped. But they're still talking about Spotsylvania during Cold Harbor. Cold Harbor pales in the comparison compared to some of the things that they've seen to this point. But by this point, this is now by mid-June 1864, the Overland Campaign, as it's known, begins winding down as Grant begins to rethink his strategy. And it's during that time that we begin to realize the impact that this has had on the men. The growing bloodshed, along with the increasing casualties and the physical challenges imposed by this campaign, begins to test the ability of the men to endure. Specifically, if you look at the numbers, by the end of this campaign, in 40 days, the Union Army loses 7,600 killed, 38,000 wounded, almost 9,000 missing, mostly captured, 55,000 casualties. And this has an impact. The survivors recognize that that is what they are, survivors. How do they process that? Why are they alive when so many of their friends are not? Union officer Stephen Weld would note, "I shall be lucky if I get through this campaign without being killed. Everyone is being killed that I know." Well, Private John Haley, the private from Maine, notes, "I calculate a 10-to-1 chance that I will expire before my term does." And on top of all this was the physical challenge. Not only are you losing friends, but this was nonstop. They fight during the day, they march at night to another battlefield where they fight again the next day. The men are increasingly asked to push themselves like never before. Colonel George Bernard, the regimental commander of the 18th Massachusetts, would write, "The suffering of the men is almost indescribable. I can hear them howling for help as they hear us groping along in the dark along our march. The men in the ranks are so utterly wretched that they throw themselves in the middle of the road, wallowing in mud, howling and crying like madmen." And all of this contributes to a decline in soldier morale. As time goes on, the casualties begin to wear down the men. The losses become overwhelming. The number of men lost, men being buried, such as here at the Wilderness Battlefield. The soldiers begin to figure out that the war's changed. Private John Stewart of the 1st Maine Heavy Artillery would note, "I am sick of this war. I am tired of the butchery of human beings." For Private Austin Kendall of the 117th New York, he identifies the exact moment when he gives up on the Union cause. He notes it was the death of a stranger. In his diary, he notes, "A man was shot in the thigh and did not have proper care, and he bled to death. We could not find out what his name was, nor what regiment or anything about him, and some boys of our regiment went and brought him to where we were and dug a grave and laid him in it. I think that was the hardest thing I ever saw." You see a crisis building in the Army of the Potomac. They cannot continue on like this. But unfortunately, they'll be asked to continue on because the Overland Campaign quickly gives way to the Petersburg Campaign. Following Cold Harbor, Grant pauses for a moment and thinks he is now at Cold Harbor. He's only miles from Richmond, but he can't get there. So he decides to get a bit more creative. He sweeps his army south of the James River and doesn't go for Richmond, but goes towards Petersburg, Virginia, which is about 30 miles south of Richmond. Petersburg, if you look at a map, you can see is where several rail lines unite and form a single rail line feeding into Richmond. You take Petersburg, you cut Richmond off from the rest of the Confederacy. Lee has to defend it. And Grant gets there. And he gets there before the bulk of Lee's forces. But something happens when he gets his army there. His army won't do what he wants it to. When his men get there, the casualties have taken their toll. And when they get there, they find, once again, Confederate soldiers. As Lieutenant Thomas Galloway notes when they arrive in Petersburg, "Our lines have advanced at all fronts, but the enemy contests every inch of ground with desperate resistance, so our loss has been very heavy." The army is not attacking very effectively at Petersburg, and the result is that they're unable to take the city. and Grant grudgingly settles in for a siege. To be fair, it's not a siege. He never actually seals the city off completely. It is a campaign to capture the city. But what happens is he realizes his men can't perform the impossible. They are exhausted. They are depleted. So he digs in, so does Lee, and waits for reinforcement. And as they do so, they begin to manufacture the most sophisticated set of trench lines seen on the North American continent. For the next 9 months, Union soldiers and Confederate soldiers would dig parallel lines, stretching over 80 miles, all the way from the east side of Richmond down to Five Forks, 30, 40 miles west of Petersburg. These entrenchments are designed to facilitate the capture or the defense of Richmond. But this goes on and on and on for reasons I'll get to. But ultimately, this is a 9-month siege, 292 days. Grant keeps trying. He keeps trying to defeat Lee's army. He throws troops around his left flank. Lee's men block him. Throws troops around his right flank. Lee's men block him. Tries to dig under it, the famous Battle of the Crater at the end of July, 1864. They dig a tunnel under the Confederate lines, fill it with gunpowder, blow it up. It works for about an hour until it doesn't disastrously. What all of this shows is Grant has developed a respect for trench warfare. You can't just throw men at trenches. Interestingly enough, the men, the guys in the ranks, had figured that out a long time earlier. And if you look at the Petersburg campaign, the bodies keep piling up. Over 9 months, it's more stretched out, but over 9 months, 50,000 more Union troops will be killed, wounded, or captured. That actual number is actually low, because about midway through the siege, they stop keeping track of day-to-day casualties. They only focus on major battles that occur, which means guys who are lost to sniper fire, artillery fire, normal day-to-day operations around Petersburg stop getting counted. So it's probably closer to 60,000 casualties. What's interesting about this, going back to Lord Moran, Moran reached the conclusion in his study of World War I that World War I was different. World War I was unique. As he says, the real difference between the war of 1914 and the wars of history is in the absence of a close period, when men, safe for the moment, could rest and build up a reserve. His point was, when you're in a trench, you're always in combat. There's always the chance that a sniper will kill you. There's always a chance that a mortar round will fall into your trench and blow you out of this world. You have no escape, and you know that. It's tremendously taxing upon the brain. But he's wrong, because there was an example of this prior to World War I, and it was at Petersburg, as these men were constantly under threat, constantly challenged to prepare themselves. Life in the trenches, much like war, was long periods of tedium, punctuated by moments of extreme violence. There were battles. There were attacks. You had to go over the top in the no man's land, although those were World War I terms. They were never used during the Civil War. But ultimately, the men realized that this was a horrible environment. Captain Samuel Rodman Smith of the 4th Delaware would write that summer, "Three of us occupy a hole 6 feet by 10 feet by 3 feet deep. We lay in our water and provisions overnight and keep pretty close during the day, especially when the bullets fly low." Private Wesley Gould of the 45th Pennsylvania agreed, noting, every night we advance a little closer with our rifle pits. Some places the lines are but a few yards apart, and if a man from either side shows his head, he is pretty sure to lose it. One soldier compared this existence to the punishment of criminals. Another declared, never was there such a beastly life as this. The point is, and this isn't exactly groundbreaking stuff, trench warfare was terrible. The soldiers were exposed to what could arguably be called modern warfare for the first time. How did they endure it? How did they survive 9 months of it and emerge triumphant at the end? And unfortunately, the answer is, at first they didn't. It's easy to find evidence in the early days of the Petersburg siege of men demoralized by the losses, of looking at the graves, the soldier graves, such as these on the wilderness battlefield, and reaching the conclusion that they were doomed. As Colonel George Bernard, the Massachusetts regimental commander, noted, men who have been through everything in this whole war are now beginning to cave. A lot of this had to do with the loss of officers. 12 general officers are killed and wounded during the Overland Campaign. More than 1,000 regimental and company commanders are killed and wounded during the Overland Campaign. These were men that had led their soldiers for years, and now they're gone. The inspiration has disappeared. But what's more important was the loss of friends. 45% of the people you fought with are gone. And the result was stress, demoralization, fatalism. What's the point? I'm not going to make it. After the Spotsylvania attack, Captain Mason Tyler of the 37th Massachusetts noted that a good friend of his had not survived. And his reaction was immediate. He wrote in a letter, "I've had a deep sense of depression, as if I were being deserted and left alone." At the end of the campaign, a Massachusetts soldier noted, "All of us see the frail threads that our lives hang upon more vividly day by day as our little band dissipates." The men lose faith in the cause. And thus, in the early days of Petersburg, as they're first exposed to trench warfare, they grow, there's no other word for it, insubordinate. Combat refusals. Soldiers, individual soldiers, whole units, refusing to make attacks. I found several examples of this that are in my book. Just one example is Private Robert McBride's 11th Pennsylvania. They're ordered to attack the Confederate position near Petersburg on June 24th. Their colonel leads them across the open ground, and they instantly come under fire from Confederate artillery. At that point, McBride notes that the men, in good order and without disorder, but without waiting for orders, moved obliquely to the right to the cover of ground. Their colonel, Colonel Carl, runs up to them and starts cursing them as cowards. "How dare you? I did not give you orders to retreat." This is McBride's description of what happened next. "The officers, almost to a man, refused to obey his orders or do anything until his insults should be retracted. The men were becoming dangerous. Carl laid his hand on his pistol. Instantly, a score of rifles were leveled upon him. He withdrew his hand, apologized to both officers and men, and we moved on to the rifle pits without further discord." Several examples of this. Is this outright mutiny? Not necessarily. This is nowhere near the kind of French mutiny that we see in World War I in 1917. It's more of the soldiers going, "Uh-uh, not this time." But as many examples as there are of combat refusals, there's more examples of this outright insubordination. Soldiers refusing to engage in any sort of extended attacks, but also refusing to take orders from the men they believe had led them astray, had led them to defeat. For instance, you see over the summer of 1864 a spike in courts-martial in the Union Army. Insubordination increases, alcoholism increases, violence between soldiers increases. And at first, the officer corps doesn't know what to do about it. One example, and poured over what really understudied court-martial records from the American Civil War, and I found many, many cases of men just refusing to take orders from commanders anymore. Private George Black's a great example. George Black, 63rd New York. These trenches that we've seen, they didn't just manifest themselves. They didn't have machinery to make them. When you needed to make a fort or a trench, you had the soldiers do it. They had shovels that they had to dig. So the soldiers are the manpower here. And so during, mostly at night, because it's cooler in Virginia and they're not being shot at as much, they're digging. And so one day, Private George Black of the 63rd New York has enough. And his lieutenant, he says he's not going to work anymore. His lieutenant orders him back to work. Black refuses. His lieutenant orders him again. Black takes a swing at his lieutenant with a shovel. He has to be restrained by his sergeant before he's arrested. What's interesting about this case is that at the trial, at the court-martial, Black is It turns out he was drunk. Turns out alcohol was a factor. But many men in the unit, including some of his officers, testify on his behalf and say, he's a 3-year veteran. This is something that's never happened before. He's a good soldier. We don't know what happened. He just had a bad day. Still, it's an Army court-martial. He gets convicted. But what really the biggest example of the problem of insubordination in the Union Army during this period is not violence or alcoholism, it's desertion. Desertion plagues the Union Army throughout 1864. As more and more men become insubordinate, more and more challenges to maintaining the ranks. Desertion rises steadily in the Union Army throughout 1864, actually. If you look, you see it spikes around October, November 1864. This is, in many ways, a consequence of the Overland Campaign. You actually have to predate each one of these, because these are the reported previous months. So if it spikes in October, it's actually September. But the result, the point of this is that by September, October 1864, 10, 11,000 Union soldiers are reported absent without leave. That was the thing about the Civil War. They weren't in Europe. They weren't in the Pacific. If you wanted to leave, you could walk home. You could hop on a train and be home in hours. And many soldiers did that. They grew demoralized with Army leadership, and they left. Rarely do you see soldiers actually come out and admit, yes, I deserted. Plenty of court-martials of desertion. Almost all of them are defending themselves, because what is the punishment for desertion? Death. Death by hanging, or firing squad, usually hanging. So rarely do you see it. One example, Private Joseph Reed in the 90th Pennsylvania. He's charged with, in the most shameful manner, abandoning arms and equipment at the Wilderness. He claims that he was actually helping wounded off the field and got lost. Not an unusual claim for battlefield desertion. But what's interesting, just like a Private Black's court-martial, he defends himself with officers and men from his regiment saying, this is a good guy. This is unusual for him. He's a veteran. Still, he is found guilty, and he's sentenced to death. However, later it would be commuted to 90 days hard labor. Not unusual for that to happen, as we'll see. He probably preferred the 90 days hard labor over the death sentence. But rarely do you see soldiers actually coming out and say, yes, I deserted. But when it is, it's very revealing. Private George Siebert of the 48th Pennsylvania, he pleads guilty for not once but twice deserting his unit in July and August 1864. His defense, I just wanted to see my family. Seems like an open and shut case. Seems like he is headed for the gallows until it is discovered over the course of the trial that he's only 15 years old. He faked his enlistment, faked his parental signature, and lied about his age. Thus, the court shows mercy. The court cites, quote, his evident youth and weak mental faculties in reducing his sentence from death to the loss of pay of $8 a month. What we see here is the men struggling, particularly early. This is the summer of 1864. They're wrestling with the legacy of the Overland Campaign. They're struggling to adapt. How do they make it? Well, they do make it. If we look at World War I, we imagine there's a certain inevitability about their decline. They will collapse at some point. The French in 1917, the Russians in 1917, the Italians in 1917, the Germans in 1918. Eventually, an army will break. I found it interesting because they go in the opposite direction. They get better. They get stronger. Their morale improves. And it's trench warfare that does it. How is this possible? Well, it's possible because we look at these images of breastworks, abattis, chevaux de frise, all the wonderful French words to describe these different fortifications, and they're imposing. And you would go, I would not want to attack that. I would not have to face that. And you know what? The men realize that too. They realize, arguably before their commanders do, that warfare has changed. As one soldier notes, Lieutenant Theodore Vail of the 2nd Connecticut Heavy Artillery, Modern warfare is largely made up of entrenching and fortifying. 100 men behind entrenchments are more than a match for 1,000 in front. The men realize that trenches are good. They save lives. They'd much rather be in the entrenchments than attacking the entrenchments. Captain George Washington Whitman of the 51st New York that July would write a letter to his older brother, a man by the name of Walt Whitman. Captain Whitman would note, "We have a very strong position here and are having pretty good easy times. If General Lee thinks he can drive us away, I wish he would pitch in, as we are all prepared for him." They enthusiastically welcome a Confederate attack because now they have an advantage. But really the line that sums up the Union perspective is Major Elijah Hunt Rhodes of the 2nd Rhode Island. "Great is the shovel and spade. I would as soon dig out the rebels as fight them." Trench warfare restores this sense of control over their environment. These men were volunteers. They were citizen soldiers, American citizen soldiers. They believed that they had voluntarily contributed their service to their country, and they deserved some respect for that. And for 3 years, they had seen, in their words, their lives wasted, being used as pawns on battlefields, marching across open ground to be slaughtered. Trenches give them physical control. The deeper you dig your hole, the deeper you make your trench, the more likely it is you will survive. You have personal responsibility for your own survival on the battlefield, finally, instead of just being one cog in a line marching across the battlefield. There's no cowardice in that, they conclude. There's a recognition that this is what we need to do to survive, but it's also what we need to do to win. And along the way, as they develop this kind of mental adaptation to trench warfare, where they embrace it, several factors serve to help them out. Some are conscious, some are unconscious, but the Union and the Union Army helps these men adjust. One thing goes back to this issue of insubordination. You see what I think is both a conscious and unconscious leniency in courts martial in the Union Army that summer. More and more men have their sentences reduced. And a wonderful example of that is Private George Black. Remember, he took a swing at his commanding officer? He is convicted. He's convicted of charges of insubordination, being drunk on duty, and attempting to strike a superior officer. He is sentenced to forfeit all pay, be dishonorably discharged, and submit to hard labor for the duration of his enlistment, a year and a half. His sentence is sent up to his division commander to review, General Nelson Miles. On that court-martial, General Miles writes a notation. "In view of the interests of the service, which requires the service of every man in the ranks, all but Private Black's forfeiture of pay is hereby commuted." Miles acknowledges, and you see this several more times, yes, he did something wrong. Yes, we need to punish him. But we need bodies. We need the men in the ranks. He is better serving his country in the uniform than in hard labor. And so many desertion and insubordination convictions get reduced down to forfeiture of pay. And that's it. To keep the men in the ranks. And so, yes, it's a pragmatic, we need the bodies. But it's also, I think, deep down, I think at least some of these officers are going, we need to cut these guys some slack. They've been through hell. These are good soldiers who are going through a bad time. But as time goes on, we see more and more steps being made to help out the men in the ranks. As Private Robert Carter of the 26th Massachusetts notes, "A soldier is happy as long as his food is good and sure." Once the soldiers reach a stationary position at Petersburg, they're able to really gain all the largesse of the Union position. City Point becomes one of the largest harbors and ports in America, as all of the Union supplies that couldn't reach them during the overland campaign because they were on the move, now they're in a fixed position, and that can be delivered to the front lines. The Union makes a railroad that goes up to the trench lines. Men are being fed out of boxcars. And the result is that the men improve. As Sergeant Samuel Clear of the 116th Pennsylvania notes, we are living fat for the very first time since leaving home. In addition to that, we see charitable organizations. Much like the logistical apparatus, we see organizations like the United States Sanitary Commission, the United States Christian Commission, deploying their resources. During the Civil War, you had volunteers from throughout the Union, primarily women, raising money to buy food, medical supplies, reading materials, everything that a soldier needed to supplement the supplies being given to them by the Army. In particular, vegetables to ward off scurvy, morphine to help numb the pain for hospitals that were short of it, newspapers to keep them informed of what was going on. More and more these resources are deployed. As one soldier notes, every soldier has reason to bless the Sanitary Commission. In addition, as the war goes on into the fall and winter months, there's an increasing realization that the war is over or ending, and they're winning. If you look at the fall of 1864, anybody who reads a newspaper can see the North is winning. Mobile falls in August. Atlanta falls in September. Victories from Philip Sheridan's army in the Valley in September and October. And the number one thing, Lincoln gets reelected in November. The soldiers see that as a big, big win. The death knell of the Confederacy. Private Wilbur Fisk of the 2nd Vermont, better than paydays is the glorious news continually coming in from our armies and the voting booths all around. The rebellion is toppling down. And this was reinforced in person. The Confederate army is beginning to collapse, and the soldiers can see it. Lee's army is plagued by desertion during this campaign, partly because they don't have many of the advantages the Union does. And the result is more and more soldiers deserting. A lot just go home to protect their families from Sherman's rampaging masses. But a lot just put up their hands and walk across no man's land and surrender. And so Union soldiers get to see Confederates, and they're amazed. They are a miserable-looking set, Corporal Daniel Chisholm said, with scarcely enough clothes to cover their nakedness. I don't think they will hold out much longer. And they didn't. After 9 months of sieges, with Union soldiers adapting to these trench warfare conditions, the operations around Petersburg would come to an end in late March, early April, 1865. Lee would try one more chance to break out at the end of March and fail. Grant, sensing weakness, throws his legions against Lee's army on April 1st, and Lee's line collapses. Lee takes his army on the run. Petersburg surrenders on April 2nd, as does Richmond. Lee's army would surrender 1 week later. To the soldiers, it was vindication. Captain Robin Smith of the 4th Delaware would write to his mother about Appomattox, saying, "Everybody here is wild with delight. Officers shook hands as if they had not seen each other for years, and between all, hats flying in the air, bands playing Yankee Doodle Dandy." But there is the deep feeling of thankfulness and gratitude which I felt that my life had been spared while many a better had fallen. It will be a day long remembered. The men who see Appomattox had endured hell. They had gone a year since their initial stepping out from the spring campaigns. They had endured the Overland campaign, they had endured trench warfare, and they had emerged victorious. They had demonstrated, these American citizen soldiers had demonstrated a tremendous ability to adapt and overcome to the challenges posed by modern or some proto-modern form of warfare, the trenches before Petersburg. These methods allowed the men to continue. And what's interesting is that some, but not necessarily all of these methods, were available to their Confederate opponents. These Union soldiers emerge triumphant and demonstrate not only just the Union victory, but the victory of the American combat soldier. These men ultimately did not shirk from the increasingly foreign battlefields that greeted them day after day in places like Spotsylvania and Petersburg. They achieved victory by silencing the demons of the Overland campaign and putting aside the terrors of trench life, at least until the war was over and they were safe at home. then the nightmares would return, as they so often do. Thank you very much.
How many Union soldiers were executed during these two campaigns that you've been talking about?
About 40. Overall, during the whole war, and this is a rough number because these are just the ones that were done officially. Every once in a while, there was a kangaroo court, and some Union officer, particularly out west, would say, "You deserted. I'm not going to go through proper channels and do this." But over the war, I believe the official number for the Civil War is 127 men executed by the Union Army for desertion, and there was approximately 30 or 40. In the book, I talk about how not only were these men executed, it was done publicly. The soldiers in the trenches were pulled out, assembled in parade formation, and they watched. The whole goal was to show these executions to as many soldiers as possible to say, to act as a deterrence. So they didn't need to kill every single deserter. They just needed to make a point. And that was the mentality. And the Union Army, the Confederate Army, we don't have good, reliable numbers, but Lee frequently resorted to executions for deserters, too, to try to stop that problem in his army. But it did not succeed. But to answer your original question, yes, several dozen during these campaigns. Ultimately, some made it to Lincoln's death. Lincoln had a tendency to pardon everybody, but not every desertion case made it to his desk.
So. Couldn't we say, given the absence of lack of World War I-style over-the-top attacks, can't we put an end to the Grant the Butcher myth?
Yeah, I don't believe it. Unfortunately, if you look, the soldiers loved Grant in March of 1864. They hate him in June of 1864 after the Overland Campaign. One soldier says he has no strategy, just hammer, 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 hammer. It just seems like he's unoriginal. Well, that's not fair. Grant did not want to throw his men against strong entrenched positions. He was trying to move his men around the flanks. The problem was, every time the Confederates had interior lines, they had a shorter distance to march to get from point A to B than the Union did, and every time there were the Confederates. So Grant's philosophy was, okay, well, if they're always there, if we get them before they dig in too much, before they really, one of his staff officers had a calculus, 24 hours and they have a strong position, 48 hours it's a deadly position, 72 hours it's impregnable. If we get them in that first 24 hours, that's when you can attack and maybe break through. And to be fair, at the Mule Shoe at Spotsylvania, they break the Confederate line. The problem is really disorganization. Grant just keeps throwing corps after corps into the breach, and so does Lee, and it becomes just a mob scene, and they're unable to exploit. Really, in a word, that is, in a single phrase, that's the problem with Civil War tactics, is a lack of an ability to exploit. They could achieve breakthroughs. To be fair, Pickett's men made it over the wall at Cemetery Ridge. But having the troops to exploit that breakthrough, that was always the problem. So yeah, I am not, Grant's trying. And partly through bad luck, partly through bad subordinates, partly through perhaps a lack of creativity on his own part, at least at first. But he learns and he gets better. He was not a butcher, no matter what Mary Lincoln said.
I was curious, in the same vein of the Grant question, when do you think he was convinced that the Union was going to win? I mean, what was the time in which you thought, well, we're going to have some issues, but slowly but surely we're going to grind this out?
That's an excellent question. Grant just has that. You can call it confidence or you can call it stubbornness, but Grant just has this notion. I mean, he thinks he's going to win from 61. Very famously he says in his memoirs that after 62, it's like, look, we needed to change how we were going to win, but we were going to win. He gets frustrated during the Overland Campaign. But part of the problem with the Overland Campaign is an unwieldy command apparatus. He's not running the Army of the Potomac. George Meade is. And so he has to relay his orders through Meade, who then has to relay the orders through the Corps commanders, who then have, and so it's frustrating for Grant not to be in charge, to be in charge, but not really running the show. And so I think he's confident that they're gonna win. He knows the numbers are on their side. He just doesn't know how long it's gonna take. And he also realizes that, you know, look at that position, the head of, you know, the head of the Union armies. You know, Lincoln had a tendency to boot anybody who failed him. He sticks with Grant partly because he doesn't want to, partly because he's got confidence in Grant, to be fair, but also he doesn't want to shake the boat right before the election. But, you know, Grant knows he's going to win. He just doesn't know how long it's going to take to get there.
I read in Ron Chernow's book on Grant that the way he did it was basically he figured the more trenches he built, the South would run out of men to man the trenches.
I'm impressed you read Chernow's book. It's an excellent book, but it's 1,000 pages. You got to want it. It's a great book, but you know, I mean, I thought Hamilton was long. His Grant's book is, you know, it's. Grant is sort of painted as the attritional commander, and that's why historians have kind of locked on to him. You know, you have Sherman, who seems to be the future of total war, taking the war to the civilians. Then you have Grant, who seems to be the future of attrition, wear down your enemy. That's not what Grant's thinking. I don't think, you know, Grant does not want to necessarily bleed out the South. He's trying to be Napoleonic. He's trying to encircle Lee's army. For many of the reasons I've already elaborated, poor command apparatus, and to be fair, as his own troops point out, you got to get past Bobby Lee first. You know, the enemy has a vote, and Lee's got one hell of a vote. So you know, Lee continues to stymie Grant as he tries, but really by June of 1864, Lee's army is a non-factor in the war. Grant bottles him up. And whether or not they bleed him out or not, Lee's army's not going anywhere. And that allows for people like Sherman to do what they do, because Lee is trapped. So I don't think Grant is necessarily thinking, let's build more entrenchments and kill a lot of Confederates. I think he believes, let's build more entrenchments and bottle them up, and then we'll be able to defeat them kind of at our leisure.
Since the Confederates could have compelled slaves to do the physical work of building entrenchments, couldn't they have been as effective and as well constructed as the Union ones?
Yes, the Union soldiers noticed that, actually. They had some rather off-color remarks about wanting to basically use Southern slaves to do the fatigue work. You know, typical griping of a soldier. It's like, why am I digging? I'm a war fighter, that sort of thing. In a way, they did. By the Petersburg campaign, there's over 35,000 African American troops in the Eastern Theater, and the reluctance of many commanders to use them as actual combat troops leads to them being relied upon as a labor force, much to the chagrin of the African American troops themselves, who don't want to dig, they want to fight, and to the Union officers, who had great faith in the ability of these men to fight, and they feel like they're basically being relegated to slave work again. But yes, in many cases, you had African-American troops being brought in to sort of replace the Union soldiers doing all the digging. But the Union soldiers did the digging. And what's interesting is they took pride in it. You know, Fort Sedgwick, Fort Sheridan, Fort Hill, places like that, they built these things and said, wow, look at all the Confederates that this is going to kill. You know, just by digging, we're winning the war, and I'm not really being shot at. So, you know, surprisingly, it was exhausting. Two things, though. One, they took pride in it. Two, they got a whiskey ration for doing fatigue duty like that, and they loved that. So,
I was struck by how you ended your talk tonight, and rather than a question, I commend an article that appeared in the science section of today's New York Times. Not just the terror and the horror these men, the survivors, experienced in battle, but a study, not proven, but strongly suggesting that their direct offspring after the war were impacted by the trauma and horror these men experienced, physically impacted.
Guess I shouldn't have read the Wall Street Journal this morning. Guess I should have read the Times. I will definitely check that out. Well, it's interesting because you've basically, if I can promote myself for a minute, touched upon what my next book is probably going to be about. As I was saying earlier to some people, I got to know these guys pretty well. And in looking at these guys, I kind of just out of my own curiosity, I lived with 170 of these guys for 10 years putting this research together, and I got to know them, and unfortunately I got to know so many of them that died. I looked up their pension applications, their widow statements, and things like that, and I've become very interested in what these guys did after the war. This was the greatest generation of the 19th century. These guys would go on to become lawyers, doctors, mayors, congressmen, presidents. They shaped the future of the country, and so much of their vision was shaped by what they saw at battlefields like Cold Harbor and Spotsylvania. And I want to understand what that did to them. And so I have no doubt at all that this had an impact on these guys and their offspring. I don't know if it was genetic. It could just be, you know, it's interesting to see some of the memoirs from these guys where they were incredibly blunt about, you know, it's like, oh, telling my 14-year-old daughter about the guy who got decapitated next to me by an artillery shell. Sitting on daddy's knee in the 1880s and hearing him tell stories of the mule shoe at Spotsylvania, I imagine had an impact on these people, on the offspring. And then they would go on and fight their own wars and become their own greatest generation. So thank you.
In reviewing all those letters and getting to know those guys, I have a perception that those folks are more religious than we are today. Was there much God talk or Bible references or spirituality?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, and that gets to something I don't want to diminish some of the other motivators of men in battle. That's not what I was trying to do here. These men talked about love of country. These men talked about religion. This men talked about fighting for the buddy next to them. My point was merely that they needed more after a while. Those were challenged and threatened by just the violence of it all. But, you know, there was one in particular, Frederick Pettit, who was a corporal from Pennsylvania, and he devout Christian, who every letter was filled with, this is God's will, etc. Takes a bullet to the arm in Cold Harbor, survives, and returns to his unit in July, gets promoted to corporal. 2 days later, he's killed by a sniper. And what's interesting is I found the letter his regimental officer wrote to his family, and it's so incredibly moving about, this is not a tragedy. His loss, your loss, is his eternal gain. So whether they spoke it or not, these men were tremendously religious figures. And one thing I did not see, they never shouted at the heavens when they played the blame game. No matter how bad things got, they never blamed a deity for that. They found more earthly reasons for the challenges that they had to overcome.
This just came in. This is from Diane. How did each side adjust how it used its artillery to attack the enemy trenches?
It's a good point. Well, here's the thing about trenches is the state of, and that's one thing I didn't really touch upon, is we got to be careful with the comparisons between Petersburg and World War I. Big differences. Artillery. It's primitive compared to what they're going to have in 1914. There's really no such thing as machine guns. Barbed wire hasn't been invented yet. No gas. But really, what the big thing, what made trenches so effective is much of the artillery was of the more horizontal, parabolic trajectories. So if you dig a trench in the ground, most of the rounds are going to go over your head. What they had, but not that many of, were mortars. Mortars are basically vertical drops that would drop the round into the trenches. The Confederates certainly had very few of those. The Union, not all that much. And what this forces them to do is it forces them to, the Union eventually rolls up these huge mortars that drop like 500-pound projectiles on, and so they can drop the rounds in the trenches, which effectively negate them. But they eventually start using things, the so-called Cohorn mortar. That was basically the birth of modern mortar artillery. Four-man crew can just pick it up, carry it into a trench, use it, and lob rounds into the enemy. So what the trenches force them to do is really innovate, because the trenches effectively negate much of the artillery at the time. So they have to develop new artillery forms in order to overcome these challenges and restore the devastating nature of firepower.
Thank you for a great presentation.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you to Stephen Sodergren for an outstanding discussion, and to Norwich University for sponsoring this program. The book is The Army of the Potomac and the Overland and Petersburg Campaigns, published by LSU Press. To learn more about the Pritzker Military Museum and Library, visit us in person or online at pritzkermilitary.org. Thank you, and please join us next time on Pritzker Military Presents.
Visit the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in downtown Chicago. Explore original exhibits on military history or be a part of a live studio audience. Watch other episodes of Pritzker Military Presents. Find out what's on at PritzkerMilitary.org.
Pritzker Military Presents is made possible by members of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library and its sponsors. The views and opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily those of the museum and library. The preceding program was produced by the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.